Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for April's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce our speaker for today, European and RCVS Specialist in Small Animal Surgery Orthopaedics, Steve Bright. Thank you, Steve. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Hello. Can everybody hear me? Hopefully you all can. Welcome this afternoon for our talk on stifle lameness in the dog. As Emma said, my name's Steve Bright. And I'm currently working, developing a new specialist centre, Manchester Veterinary Specialist, and we'll be opening this summer as part of the CVS referrals group. So anyway, we'll move on with the talk. That's enough about me. So we're looking at stifle lameness in the dog. The aims of this webinar will be to discuss the conditions causing stifle lameness in the dog. We'll look at the presentation, diagnosis and treatment options for these conditions. We'll take more of an in-depth look in the more common conditions, and then I'll do a bit of an introduction and overview of some of the less common conditions that we see. So the things that stifle lameness have, that can cause stifle lameness, the common ones, as most of you will know, will be things like cranial cruciate ligament rupture or disease and patellar luxation in either a medial or lateral direction. Some of the less common causes are things like collateral ligament injury. We occasionally see stifle OCD and stifle neoplasia. The causes are varied, so we have to have an open mind going into things, but also common things are common. So things like cranial cruciate ligament are a common source of presentation for stifle lameness. And obviously, with looking at pelvic limb, these lamenesses are characterized by a pelvic limb lameness, a hind limb lameness. We might see stifle pain, we may see a degree of swelling and some effusion. So if we look firstly into cranial cruciate ligament rupture or disease, this is the most common cause of pelvic limb lameness in the dog, and in all patients we should have this on our differential diagnosis list, because potentially any patient can develop this, although it is uncommon to see it in sight hounds. I've seen it once, but part of a global knee, so part of with accompanying other ligamentous injuries. So the common breeds that are affected, in the large breeds we typically see it in Labradors, Rottweilers, Golden Retrievers, Boxers, and in the smaller breeds we'd be looking at things like West Highland White Terriers and Bichon Frise. Looking into the pathogenesis, for a long time we thought that the cruciate disease or cruciate rupture that we see in small animals or in dogs mimics that we see in people. It tends to be a traumatic disease process in people, and so occasionally we will see traumatic events, but it's not very common. Nowadays we're looking more at this being a degenerative condition. So in the case of trauma, we do see them periodically, but they're often associated with other ligament damage, and generally are involved with some form of trauma, like a hyperextension or excessive internal rotation. So a patient getting their foot caught, and we'll sometimes see dogs jumping over a gate and they get their leg caught in the gate, that type of injury. So more typically we would be looking at the degenerative form of the condition, and in these patients we can see partial tears and complete tears. The cause of the degeneration within the ligament is currently unclear. Possible things that may contribute to development of cranial cruciate ligament disease for patients such as West Highland White Terriers is increased tibial plateau angle. So they have a steep tibial plateau angle. This causes excessive pressure through the ligament, and then they can develop rupture. Whether we have ongoing osteoarthritis prior to the development of the changes within the ligament, or whether there are actually changes within the ligament soft tissue structure itself. If we look at the history for these patients, this can be sort of a varying degree of lameness. Some patients have a mild level of lameness. Some patients will be completely non-weight bearing. typically the stance that a patient, that a dog with cranial cruciate ligament disease will adopt is a toe touching stance. So when they're standing, they don't fully weight bear through the limb. The onset can be acute if they're out exercising. The lameness can develop during that period, or we can also get insidious onset where the lameness will come about over several days to weeks. Stiffness after rest is something that we see typically with partial tears, or more commonly with partial tears, and often the lameness will deteriorate following a period of exercise. And again, that type of historical feature or historical finding is more common with patients with partial tears. We can see it as a bilateral condition, so more often than not we will be looking at unilateral pelvic limb lameness, but some patients will present with shifting lameness where you're developing lameness in both legs simultaneously, and one worse at one time and then the other becoming worse at a later date. And we would often, when discussing cruciate rupture or cruciate disease with clients, will often talk about development of the condition in the contralateral limb. So a study that we performed as part of the group when I was working at Northwest Surgeons, we looked at about 57% of patients would return to us within a 2-year period for management of the following of the contralateral limb. When we're looking at clinical examination, the area that we want to focus on, obviously assessing the stifle, but we're looking also at the quadriceps muscle. Often these patients will develop quadriceps muscle atrophy quite quickly. We'll look for periarticular soft tissue swelling, particularly on the inside of the stifle, so medial buttressing we would term that. Effusion, so when palpating the straight patellar ligament, we will be looking at this being a very crisp structure, and sometimes when we lose that definition, that will be an indication that there's an effusion present. If we have stifle instability, so cranial draw instability or cranial tibial thrust, this is a sort of cardinal sign really with cranial cruciate ligament deficiency. We know that the cruciate ligament is insufficient if we have either of these instabilities. Occasionally when assessing cranial tibial thrust, there will be a limited amount of movement there, and that might indicate either that we've got a partial tear or that there's a marked amount of periarticular fibrosis which prevents the movement of the stifle. And then if we're looking with manipulation, we might see that there's a degree of discomfort with extension, and that seems to be more common when patients have a partial tear. So when assessing instability, we can do that in the conscious patient, but it's a much more sensitive procedure, or more sensitive diagnostic tool when performed when the patient's under general anaesthesia or under sedation. Whilst the patient is under sedation or anaesthesia, we will often perform radiography, and the things that we'll be looking for there are an increase in soft tissue opacity, which will obscure the infrapatellar fat pad, displace the caudal fascial planes. So in this particular image here, we can see that, if I can get there we go. If we look in this area here, the infrapatella, the dark area, is much reduced. We've got an increase in soft tissue opacity, which is encroaching on the infrapatella fat pad. And if we look on the caudal aspect of the joint, the fascial planes here start to become displaced, and so we get caudal bulging of the fascial planes there. So that's something that can be a subtle indicator, rather than looking at some of the bony abnormalities. If we're then looking at the osseous structures, we can get cranial displacement of the tibia, and we can also get osteophyte formation. And the typical areas that we see osteophyte forming are on the distal and proximal pole of the patella. We'll be looking at the proximal trochlea, on the fibelli, and then on the cranial and caudal aspect of the tibial plateau. Arthrocentesis is useful for assessing whether there is a sort of gross abnormality. This is something that can be performed relatively easily. We're looking at the volume for all joints of synovial fluid to be less than 5 millimeters. So if you 5 milliliters, if you have an increased volume, then that's typically an indicator that there's intra-articular pathology. So on the images here, we can see this is a large volume of blood-singed joint fluid. The viscosity will often be reduced if it's abnormal, so normally we would expect to be able to create a string between fingers, as seen in the lower image, and with abnormality that viscosity reduces, so we don't get the string in between fingers when we palpate or sort of assess that manually. And the colour should normally be a sort of straw coloured fluid, so if we get blood tinging or it becomes cloudy, then we're looking at an abnormality. And then in terms of the synovial fluid cytology, this is something that can be readily performed in the clinic. We will often use a DiffQuick for assessing the joint fluid, so we make an in-house smear. And really what we're looking for there is the differentiation between this being a mononuclear population of cells, or whether we're looking at an increased number of neutrophils or polymorphonucleocytes. If we have an increased number of polymorphonucleocytes, so over 15%, then there could be an inflammatory process going on. So either an immune-mediated inflammatory process or a septic arthritis. The cell numbers, again, will increase. Usually we've got a low number of cells. If we have a cruciate, a cranial cruciate ligament deficiency, then often our synovial fluid will either come within the normal range or the degenerative joint disease range. So we've got a relatively low number of overall cell counts. Once we move into the inflammatory arthropathies, such as immune-mediated or septic arthritis, then we get much higher levels of cells, much higher numbers of cells. So although not necessarily definitive, they can give us supportive information. The best way to achieve a definitive diagnosis is with visual assessment of the ligament. So if we've got palpation that the joint's unstable, that there's cranial draw instability or cranial tibial thrust, then we know that the ligament is deficient. But to get a definitive diagnosis, we'll look at assessing that, and we'll perform either an arthrotomy or arthroscopy. These are two arthroscopic images of a partial tear on the lower image and a complete tear in the upper image. A medial arthrotomy would be preferable, and we can do this through a limited incision. Non-invasive assessment of the joint, we could look at MRI, although this is an expensive imaging modality, and low field MRI is not necessarily so specific when it comes to subtle changes within the cruciate ligament. So as we said, with an arthrotomy, we would typically perform this via a limited medial approach, a mini medial arthrotomy, and we'll implement the use of stifle distractors. These are a surgical instrument that you can pick up from, I think, vet instrumentation at the most common place to find these. Other companies may produce them, Vitisco or possibly Braun or other companies may produce these as well. And these are very useful because we can place the distractors within the joint. They go into the joint in a closed fashion, such as these lower images, a closed fashion. So you place them within the joint and then they have a speed lock. And we can distract the joint by using the speed lock, and that opens the jaws up, and then we can see within the joint, and that allows us to pass a probe within the joint and assess the menisci as well. So in terms of management options for us, the sort of main, the two main groups that, that treatment falls into is either a conservative approach, a non-surgical approach, or we would be looking at a surgical management. So in terms of conservative care, I tend to look at this in five main areas. So we're looking at weight control, exercise management, the use of hydrotherapy, and my picture seems to have disappeared of the hydrotherapy, the tank there, and then non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs and nutraceuticals. So weight control, keeping the patients as lean as possible. We know that carrying excessive body weight can accelerate an arthritic process, so we want to try and keep the patients as lean as we possibly can. Typically for exercise management, I will often start patients with low levels of exercise, so a period of complete rest to start with. I'm quite strict about that to allow the joint tissue to settle down, and then gradually increase the amount of lead activity that we do. Over a 6-week period, I often start at 15 minute lead walks 2 to 3 times a day, and then increase by about 5 minutes each walk each week. And that's just the way that I do that. That seems to work for me. Thereafter, we can start the reintroduction of off lead activity, and again, that can gradually increase towards normal over a further 6 week period. Hydrotherapy can be useful. We can patients on an underwater treadmill, which should be the picture in there, or we can use a hydrotherapy pill to try and maintain some muscle mass. Non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are useful in the control of discomfort when a patient has a cruciate deficient stifle. And then in terms of nutraceuticals, there's limited data on the use of nutraceuticals, but at the moment the most literature-based evidence that we have revolves around the administration of omega-3 fatty acids, which can be found in high levels in fish oil. A conservative approach, we might see a better response in smaller patients, patients under 10 to 15 kilos, but what I often find with conservative care is that when the patient is restricted in exercise or when they're on non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, their clinical signs will improve, and that's very common in patients with a partial tear. But as soon as we increase the levels of lead walking or even any form of activity, the lameness tends to return, and also once the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs are withdrawn, the lameness seems to return. So for me, the outcome with conservative care is somewhat unpredictable, and therefore I would consider surgery having a more predictable outcome, and that's certainly mimicked or sort of reflected in the surgical literature that's out there, in the veterinary literature that's out there. So the surgical techniques that are available, so historically we can use things like over the top, we can use an extracapsular suture, and then sort of more recently other forms of extracapsular suture rather than just a lateral fibrillotibial suture have become apparent, and then the osteotomy techniques such as TPLO, cranial tibial closing wedge, tibial tuberosity advancement, TTA, and then also tibial tuberosity, triple tibial osteotomy as well, a TTO. And the aim of these procedures is typically really to try and reduce the amount of cranial tibial thrust, the amount of translation that the tibia undergoes during the stance phase of the gait. In terms of over the top, this technique revolves around using a fascial graft. The initial strength of the graft is only about 30% of the original ligament in veterinary patients, so it's a fairly weak repair, and often the graft will resorb over time, and therefore this technique has kind of fallen out of favour, certainly at a referral level. And then we move to extracapsular sutures. So as I mentioned before, the fibrillotibial suture, nylon suture, is the most classic treatment for this, the most commonly performed technique. And with this technique, we'll often see suture failure, either stretching or breaking of the that new sort of synthetic ligament or the ligament substitute, within the first 3 to 6 weeks. Ultimately, we're looking at long-term fibrosis to try and provide stability to the joint. More recently, the tightrope technique has been developed, which uses fiber wire and multifilament non-absorbable suture that can provide longer-term stability to the stifle, and that's a procedure that's being used more frequently now. The longer term data is a little lacking. There are some, or there is certainly one paper out there that suggests that it can have a similar result to TPLO surgery. It's not a technique that I've used. Anecdotally, there is a reported high incidence of infection with that technique, but that's probably down to technician or surgeon error rather than the actual the procedure or the material itself. Looking at the osteotomy techniques, TPLO, with this technique we're reducing the tibial plateau angle to try to neutralize cranial tibial thrust, whereas TTA, the movement of the tibial tuberosity in a cranial direction changes the angle of insertion of the patellar ligament, and that in turn reduces the shear forces of the tibial femoral joint. And a TTO procedure, this basically combines tibial plateau leveling along with tibial tuberosity advancement. So in terms of selecting the best technique, for a long time all of these techniques tended to come out in comparative studies as much of a muchness. They also had similar outcomes, but there has been recent literature to suggest that actually we may have a superior outcome when using TPLO, and there's certainly a couple of papers there. Nelson paper from 2013 and the Gordon Evans paper from 2013 that suggests that TPLO give a superior functional outcome compared to extracapsular suture. The Mary Sarah Berg paper from 2014 on the back of the bottom of the last slide, that's a systematic review of the surgical treatments, and that's been probably the biggest study looking at all of the techniques that are available. So at the moment, my preferred technique, which has been for a while, and certainly now there's literature-based evidence for it as a technique, is TPLO. And the reasons for that is we see a lower late meniscal injury rate compared to TTA. So for TPLO, we'd be looking at about 1.5 to 2% late meniscal injury rate, but with TTA, we're looking at over 10%. So that in itself is for me an indication that the stifle is still unstable to a degree because there's ongoing trauma to that medial meniscus. The treatment for partial tears, TPLO can take the pressure off the ligament and can reduce the deterioration of the ligament and actually stop the ligament deteriorating in some cases. And there's also reduced radiographic osteoarthritic change comparing extracapsular suture to TPLO. So the TPLO patients have less osteophyte formation around the joint comparing those to patients having had an extracapsular suture. And the upshot of the 2014 systematic review was that the technique most likely to return maximal limb function was TPLO from the literature that's out there. Some of the other, we have to take that a little bit with a pinch of salt, because some of the other techniques don't have as much data as there is with TPLO. So as time goes on, that potentially alters, but from the information that we currently have, TPLO would be considered the treatment of choice. And this is just a patient, an interesting case, a dog that presented for a contralateral craniocruciate ligament rupture. This dog had had 6 years previously TPLO surgery, and there's very, very minimal soft tissue change around that joint. If we look at the fascial planes, the fascial planes are nice and crisp. There's minimal displacement of the infrapatellar fat pad, and minimal osteoarthritic change as well. The arthritic change within the joint, if we look at the patella, there's minimal osteophyte, limited osteophyte formation. Same on the fibula, and same on the proximal tibia as well. So in terms of the assessment surgically of the joint, I think it's very important not only to assess the state of the ligament, but also to assess the state of the meniscal cartilages, and that's often done at the same time. So we're not only making a diagnosis when we perform a perform an arthrotomy, so we're diagnosing the cranial cruciate ligament rupture, but we're also looking for any concurrent meniscal pathology. So the medial meniscus is the side that is most commonly affected, and that's due to it having a much more firm attachment to the tibia compared to the lateral meniscus. The lateral meniscus also has a meniscofemoral ligament, which causes movement of the meniscus during stifle movement, and that keeps the lateral meniscus out of the way. It's less likely to get trapped and traumatized. When we're assessing, as in this particular picture here, when we're assessing the menisci, probing increases our rate of detection of a meniscal injury. And so this is a probe going in underneath medial meniscus, and this is actually medial meniscus forwards here. In terms of complications for the management, when we're looking at surgical management of cranial cruciate ligament rupture or deficiency, infection is always a potential risk with any surgical treatments that we perform. Infection rates are relatively small. TPLO has possibly got a higher infection rate than other surgical techniques, and in some papers has been documented at around 5 to 7%. Although as time is moving on, those infection rates seem to be reducing. And that's certainly something that I've seen with my surgical patients as time's gone on. And that may relate to surgical technique, may relate to experience of the surgeon, may also relate to hospital antibiosis policies as well, things like that. Late meniscal injury, in my experience, tends to occur around 6 to 12 months after surgery, so much further down the line, usually when patients are returning to a normal level of activity. And if they're running around and become lame and there's limited response to a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug, then at that point my suspicion would turn to a late meniscal injury. Implant failure, so we know that an extracapsular suture, a nylon lateral fibrotibial suture, will fail. That's par for the course, but that doesn't necessarily alter the outcome of the technique. If we get a situation such as this radiograph here, where we have the screws losing purchase, we have collapse of the osteotomy site, so we've got implant loosening and failure of union here, then obviously that's more of an issue and more of a something that potentially requires revision. Tibial fractures, tend not to see those with extracapsular suture placement, similar to fibular fractures. Most of those are associated with the osteotomy techniques. Tibial fracture is an uncommon thing. Tibial tuberosity fracture we may see with TTA or TPLO. Fibular fractures tend to be related to when we're rotating the proximal osseous fragment in a TPLO. Then we'll see increased stress across the fibula and potentially see fracture associated with that. Doesn't tend to affect outcome as long as we don't get collapse of the lateral side of the joint and deviation of the limb. And then development of osteoarthritis, is that a complication? Is that par for the course? I've just put that in there for completeness, really. The argument for using TPLO is that the development of osteoarthritis is slowed. As we've seen, we know that the development of osteophyte formation slows, but that's a marker or a albeit not a very accurate marker of osteoarthritic change. So the debate still rages about the slowing of the progression of osteoarthritis with TPLL. And so then that moves us on from cranial cruciate ligament deficiency to patellar luxation. This, I would say, is the most common, second most common condition that we see in the stifle in the dog. And it can be in either a medial or lateral direction. Medial is much more common in all breeds, and typically for the smaller breeds, we'd be expecting to see that in the terriers or the toy breeds. But we can also see patellar luxation in the larger dogs and breeds such as Labradors, Mastiffs, and Akitas can be affected. And although we see lateral, lateral patellar luxation more commonly in larger breeds than smaller breeds, medial patellar luxation is still more common even in the large guys. So patellar luxation can be a complex series of multiple level orthopedic abnormalities, and so we can get tibial torsion, we can get femoral varus, and then as in this patient we can get hip dysplasia and coxa valga, so we get an increased inclination angle and that causes significant bowing of the stifle, and these abnormalities tend to be the primary issue, and the patellar luxation comes about as a secondary abnormality because the patella is told where it needs to be by the quadriceps mechanism, and the changes within the limb have dictated where that patella is going to lie. So we're often looking at the cause of this being the developmental, so that's the most common and predisposed breeds, as we've already said. So we've got in the pictures here the Akitas, Cavalier King Charles, Chihuahuas, Yorkshire Terriers, and those breeds that would be they'd be a common presentation for pelvic limb lameness within those breeds. Certainly Cavalier King Charles, that's an uncommon breed to see cranial cruciate ligament deficiency. It's much more likely to see a medial patellar luxation in those patients. We can see it as a result of trauma. Occasionally we lose the patellofibular ligament and that can cause disruption of the supporting structures around the patella, and that can cause the patella to drift either in a medial or lateral direction. And it can also be a result of other orthopedic disease. So if we get coxa valga, or if we've performed a femoral head and neck excision on a patient, then we may get a deviation of the stifle and subsequent patellar luxation developing thereafter. The diagnosis of patellar luxation is a clinical diagnosis, and we do it using palpation, and we grade patellar luxation on a 1-4 scale. So grade 1 patients, we're looking at the patella being within the trochlea. We can luxate the patella, but as soon as we let go, it will immediately return into the trochlea. For a grade 2 patient, the patella sits within the trochlea. It will easily luxate and stay luxated, but then it will return to the trochlea either following manipulation of the stifle or if the patient extends the limb. In a grade 3 patient, the patella is luxated, so it's out with the trochlea at the time of assessment. You can return the patella to the trochlea, but it immediately reluxates. And a grade 4 is where the patella is out of the trochlea, and you can't return it to within that trochlea. When we're palpating the patella, and as we feel the patella moving, we may detect crepitus, and that's often an indication that there's cartilage erosion on the articulating surface of the patella and also on the medial trochlear ridge. So we might want to look at arthrocentesis in this situation. I don't typically perform that as a part of an assessment for a patient with patellar luxation, but often this, if we did perform that, if we saw that there was an effusion there and we wanted to take a sample, often the synovial fluid cytology would be suggestive of a normal joint or a degenerative joint disease type picture. And then the other thing to be aware of is, have we got concurrent disease? So it's not an uncommon finding to have patients with medial patella luxation to also have concurrent cranial cruciate ligament deficiency. Radiography is useful to assess the stifle for other abnormalities, so we can look at the limb conformation. And although these radiographs here are focusing on the stifle, we will often perform a full limb radiograph. So we'll look at the hock all the way to the hip, so we can assess and see if there are any of these major conformational abnormalities that may complicate treatment. So you might find that the radiographs show normal finding. We might look and find some increase in soft tissue opacity, particularly if there is a concurrent cranial cruciate ligament rupture. But also I find that there's an increase in soft tissue opacity in patients when they've got a cartilage erosion. So they may not have a deficiency in the cruciate ligament, but they might have an effusion there. And often those patients will have a loss of cartilage within the joint. And they'll sometimes develop osteophyte alongside that. So again, if we've got osteophyte there, it may be that we have concurrent cruciate rupture, but also we might have erosion of the cartilage, and that has a very triangular point to this is the sort of my sort of observation really of osteophyte formation in the stifle, that we get this almost a sort of triangular point. Osteophyte on the distal pole of the patella. So in terms of treatment, we're often looking at trying to perform treatment as early as possible to limit the progression of osteoarthritis, although even with early surgical treatment, osteoarthritic change can develop within the stifle. If we can limit the conformational changes in a young growing patient, then hopefully we can keep that stifle functional and keep the patella within the trochlea for the remainder of the patient's days. The mainstay of treatment of patella luxation is to try and realign the quadriceps mechanism. So the quadriceps mechanism, that will dictate where the patella lies in the limb. So there's a fixed point at the top near the hip, there's a fixed point at the bottom, sort of distally, where the straight patella ligament inserts onto the tibial tuberosity, and the patella will sit within that quadriceps mechanism. So we need to realign the mechanism to try and improve patella tracking, and that's often done with a tibial tuberosity transposition, or in more severe cases where there's significant distal femoral varus, we may need to do a distal femoral osteotomy, a closing wedge. The trochlea, again, if that's considered shallow, then a supplementary treatment I would consider so this isn't the mainstay of the treatment, is deepening the trochlea, and we can do that either with a wedge recession sulcoplasty or a block recession sulcoplasty. Some patients have a sufficient trochlea, and realigning the quadriceps mechanism is enough, and we don't have to do a trochleoplasty. Those patients will they tend to have a more comfortable stifle after surgery. The trochleoplasty, sulcoplasties can be uncomfortable. So in terms of comfort post-operatively, then we might see an improvement if we don't have to perform one of those supplementary techniques. And then in terms of the redundant tissue laterally, a lateral joint imbrication, obviously that's for a medial patella luxation. We'd have to do medial imbrication for a lateral patella luxation, but joint imbrication is trying to increase the tension within those stretched soft tissues. So in terms of treatment, grade ones, I will often monitor a grade one and see what happens. Sometimes it will stay as a grade one. Occasionally we'll see improvement. Occasionally we'll see deterioration, but I wouldn't rush into surgery in those patients. They can often be asymptomatic. Grade two patients, I think these are probably this is the grey zone, really. This is the area where most of these patients we would offer surgical treatment, because most of the patients, when they present to the clinic, are symptomatic and they have got clinical signs associated with the patellar luxation. So we'll often do a surgical procedure, but we may monitor and see what happens in some cases. Grade 3s and grade 4s, we would in almost all cases recommend surgical treatment, because the patella is tracking out with the trochlea, and that's not a normal stifle anatomy. If we have concurrent cranial cruciate ligament deficiency with patellar luxation, then sometimes managing the patellar luxation on its own can improve the stability of the stifle, and that may be enough to resolve the clinical signs. Occasionally we will perform a TPLO surgery with tuberosity sort of realignment, as dictated or as illustrated from this 2010 Marcel and Little, or Langenbeck and Marcel and Little paper, where the two procedures are treated with during the same procedure. So there's lateralization of the tibial tuberosity during the rotation with a TPLO. So if we look at the radiographs on this distal section, we can see that the patella's lying in a medial position, and then with rotation we can see that the patella's lying within the trochlea there. More recently, there have been developments in prostheses for patellar luxation. So the patellar groove replacement, some patients where they've lost a huge amount of cartilage within the joint may benefit from a replacement of the trochlear groove. So we maintain the patella and replace the trochlea with a metallic implant. And in the study that's been performed on that, we've got complete resolution of visible lameness in a significant proportion of patients. 24 out of 35 patients, and the lameness had completely resolved. So this is potentially a useful addition to our already quite wide variety of surgical treatments for medial patella or for patellar luxation. The ridge stop is a new development from OrthoMed, and this is seen to be the panacea of medial patellar luxation treatment. So regardless of the cause, we place a plastic structure with screws, cortical bone screws, onto the medial trochlear ridge, and that hopefully prevents the patellar luxating. It's meant to be an easily performed procedure. I have seen limited numbers of these cases. The cases that I have seen have had significant soft tissue discomfort from the tracking over that area. So, to my knowledge, there are no surgical studies that look at this particular technique, and as yet the data, the sort of treatment data out there, I think is limited. So until we get that data, the jury's out on this procedure. In terms of patellar luxation complications, the most common one is reluxation, and so I'll always tell owners that the patella can reluxate after the procedure, even despite our best efforts. Infection's quite low risk. We see that very, very infrequently with this particular technique. Implant failure, so that's bending or breaking of the pin. We use a pin and the tension band wire often to stabilize the tibial tuberosity once it's been transposed. And that, in this particular radiograph, we can see that the tension band wire has ruptured. We can get breaking of the pin, or we can also get migration. The pin will often back out. That's the most common type of implant failure that I would see. We can get migration of the wedge, which is, again, it's an uncommon finding, but something that is described. If we do wedge recession sulcoplasty, the wedge doesn't integrate with the cancellous bone within the distal femur, and we end up losing that, and the wedge migrates. Cheese wiring is where the bone surrounding the metallic implants, or around the K wire, will fail, so the bone fails rather than the implant failing. And then again, as we said earlier on, progression of osteoarthritis can develop. The prognosis for these patients is generally pretty favourable. Most patients tend to have a pretty good outcome. If they don't have complications, the outcome tends to be quite favourable, although in my experience it can take them a little bit of time to improve the function. You know, rather than with a TPLO, I would expect after about 6 weeks the lameness to be very mild. Some of these patients have still got quite a lot of muscle atrophy with patellar luxation corrective surgery, and that takes a little bit of time to improve, and so they may need a little bit more in terms of rehab after the procedure. Times when we would get less predictable outcome, whether there's cartilage erosion, that may influence the outcome for some of these patients. And if they've got higher grade, so if we've got grade 4 procedures, then the complications tend to be higher in rate, and also the outcome may be a little bit less predictable. So now moving on to very infrequent or sort of less common conditions that we see that will cause pelvic limb lameness, or caudal cruciate ligament rupture. I've only seen a couple of cases of these. They're pretty uncommon in the veterinary world. It's a much more common condition in humans because it's seen as a dashboard injury. So there's a cranial force on the tibia that will cause the stressing of the ligament and cause the ligament to fail. So it's not something that we see particularly commonly certainly in the canine or orthopedic, veterinary orthopedic world in general, but it's often in combination with other ligaments, so we'd get failure of the cranial cruciate ligament and the collateral ligaments as well. In terms of diagnosis, radiography, we could see that there's caudal displacement of the tibia. We get caudal draw rather than cranial draw, and with visual assessment we can look at this, and that's something that we might see arthroscopically. And in terms of treatment, we could place an extracapsular suture going on the medial aspect of the stifle from the caudal tibia to the distal pole of the patella, but we may also opt to pursue a more conservative approach. Then on to collateral ligament rupture. Again, tends to be associated with trauma, and often in combination with other ligaments. But we may see spraining, and we may, as in this case, see complete rupture. This is a medial collateral ligament that's ruptured. And sometimes the rupturing, rather than the ligament failing, it's the interface between the ligament and the bone, so we can get avulsion fragments forming. Diagnosis for this would be an uncomfortable stifle, so we'd be looking at levels of discomfort, and it could be the medial or the lateral collateral ligaments that are affected, or both, and so we'd be looking at medial or lateral instability, and this needs to be assessed with the stifle in an anatomically reduced position in extension, because you will get a degree of medial or lateral instability if the stifle is in a flex position. And then treatment for these cases, often looking at reconstruction of the ligament, so using tissue anchors and a ligament substitute. And in this case, we've used a nylon leader line. Stifle OCD is an uncommon condition that's seen in juvenile patients. So we'll be looking at patients typically under 12 months of age, and it tends to affect the femoral condyles. It's reported most commonly in the lateral side, but actually this radiograph is of a patient with medial femoral condylar OCD, so we can see the subchondral bone lucency on radiography here. We can see that there's effusion, we've got displacement or sort of bulging of the joint fluid here and displacing these caudal fascial planes, and again sort of obscuring of the infrapatellar fat pad. We may see mineralized bodies within the joint, and again so we can look at these arthroscopically. On the medial lateral view, it's not quite so obvious on this radiograph, but we're looking at flattening. So this femoral condyle here looks in reasonable alignment, but we can see flattening the medial humeral condyle radiograph there. Treatment of this condition is pretty challenging because their short-term outcome is quite favourable, but their long-term outcome is not so good. So in terms of treatment, we'd be looking at flap removal or debridement, and the video we'll show in a second is relates to that. So we can do it as an open approach, or we can do it arthroscopically. Possibly replacing the articular cartilage using an osteoarticular transfer system. The OATS system has been reported, but again, sort of longer term outcomes not great. So this can be quite a debilitating condition. So this is an arthroscopy video looking in a right stifle. I think it relates to the radiographs that we've just seen there, looking on the on the femoral condyle, and we can see that there's a loss in the articular surface. We can see exposed subchondral bone. We can use small arthroscopic grasping forceps. These are universal rongeurs to take away some of the loose cartilage at the periphery of the lesion. Using an arthroscopic probe, we can assess to see whether we've got back to. So what we want to do is remove all of the underrun cartilage. So this is just probing along here. We can see that those lower sections, the more distal sections, are still underrun, whereas proximally they're well adhered. And then once the fragments and the loose cartilage has been removed, then we can use, this is a hand burr, debriding the subchondral bone. And that will hopefully allow us to see some vascular integration there, so we get some new blood vessels, bringing hopefully fibrocartilage to that area further down the line. And then for sort of to finish on a slightly sort of sad topic, I suppose, but for our older patients, we could be considering neoplasia. So for the clinical presentation, we'd be looking at these patients being painful, and often they're accompanied with marked swelling. And when we radiograph these patients, we'd be looking at seeing an aggressive bone lesion. So we would look for osteolucency, we'd look for osteoproliferation, so new bone formation, particularly periosteal new bone formation. And then also increasing the soft tissue opacity associated with these changes. And typically we figure that 90% of aggressive bone lesions would indicate or would be neoplastic, only 10% of them being osteomyelitis. And actually in my experience, very, very few of these cases tend to be osteomyelitis, although this radiograph given to me by a colleague is of a cat that's went missing for a couple of weeks, and had when the cat was last seen, the cat was absolutely fine, a young cat of about 2 years of age, and it looks like it's developed an open fracture, and then osteomyelitis has sort of set in this particular case. So the possibilities, we could be looking at a primary bone tumour, the most common of which being osteosarcoma, but we could also be looking for soft tissue tumours such as synovial cell sarcoma, histiocytic sarcoma, fibrous or chondrosarcoma, and also the possibility of a metastatic tumour as well. And in terms of primary bone disease, as we said, osteosarcoma is by far and away the most common. We're looking at this arising in the metaphyseal bone. And there's a similar incidence in a stifle relating to either the proximal tibia or the distal femur, so close to the stifle, away from the elbow, as we say. These cases, the radiographic changes don't cross the joint space. Whereas looking at a soft tissue sarcoma, we would be looking at these potentially crossing the joint space. So in this particular radiograph, we can see that there's osteolucency in the proximal tibia, but we've also got a slight loss in the cortical definition in the distal femur as well. And there's increase in soft tissue opacity all over this area. So in terms of neoplasia, so metastasis is an uncommon cause of neoplasia. If we want to be definitive about the diagnosis, then biopsy is the only way to be able to be definitive. We can have our high levels of suspicion, but really we need biopsy to be able to give a definitive answer if the owners wish to pursue further treatment or further staging. And then in terms of thoracic imaging, looking at radiography or CT of the thorax, that can assess for pulmonary metastases. And if we see pulmonary metastasis, then we know that we're dealing with a neoplasm. And in some ways, the underlying cause of this is academic, because the outlook's probably not great for the patient, unfortunately. So that's the an overview of stifle lameness in the dog. I'm sorry for some of the technical issues there, but I hope that would that people have enjoyed that. And if anybody's got any questions, I will be happy to answer them. Okay, so one of the questions that's come through is, how do you assess the trochlear depth for medial patellar luxation cases? What I typically do is use a straight-edged instrument, so something like a scalpel blade handle, and I lie that across the trochlear ridges, so from the medial to lateral trochlear ridge. And what that does is allow us to perform an assessment, and it's a visual assessment. There's no sort of measurement particularly, but it's a visual assessment as to how recessed that trochlear is. And if it doesn't look particularly recessed, then for me, I would look at trying to reduce the or increase the depth there by doing a recession sulcoplasty. Another question, do you have a preferred age for surgery for immature dogs with medial patellar luxation? My take on that, I would probably look at dealing with that patient as early as I possibly could. One of the issues that we can come across is if we've got a malalignment and we're thinking about doing a tuberosity transposition, then we can potentially damage the physis of the tibial tuberosity, and that can theoretically cause problems for us further down the line. This was a discussion that we had at a recent referral clinicians meeting, and some of the clinicians were using the soft tissue technique, so looking at really just imbrication. That's not something that I've done. I've always been a little more aggressive than that, but I've tended to deal with it sooner rather than later. Certainly 6 months upwards, I wouldn't have any concerns about growth, tibial tuberosity, physeal growth or lack thereof. Younger than that, I might be a little bit more concerned about it, and maybe looking at some of the soft tissue techniques might be more appropriate. I think that's everything. There's no other questions coming through right now.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Steve for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.